Talk given Friday, 13th October, 1978. It seems to me we can best approach the points which have been raised by reminding ourselves of the real meaning of the word man. You know how in Genesis, the very first chapter, we find in verse 26, and Elohim, that is the universal creative process, translated usually as God. And Elohim said, let us make man in our own image. And you also know how often I have said that I would prefer that to be translated this way in English. And Elohim minded, let us create man in our own living likeness. I think if you use that translation, you will get much deeper significances out of it. Let us create man, not make man. The word make has this sort of mechanical aspect to it. You make something, make a plum pudding or make a statue or make a house or a plan or whatever it is. That has nothing to do with creation. Let us create man out of the primordial state of the quiescence of creative energy, activity sets in and brings forth that which is named man. And the word man from the Sanskrit root man, which is usually translated as to think, is a hopeless translation because of the verb manyate, which is generally translated as to think. The word man does not, the root, the Sanskrit root man means really to mind. So we must understand that mind in this context is something quite different from what we ordinarily mean by mind. One may suggest that this word mind is one of the archetypal forms of the primordial creative energy which releases cosmos out of primordial chaos. Chaos not meaning disorder, but meaning this creative energy in a state of vibrant quiescence. Not static, not dynamic. When the dynamism sets in, then forms and shapes and particular manifestations come into being. So now, the word man from man, meaning mind, and creation, the creative process involved therein, means that man is fundamentally an expression of creative activity by virtue of mind. See? Very good. And this has no relationship to our word to think, which merely means a string of words. A string of words which makes meaningful patterns for our brain activity. But these patterns, unless and until they can be put into action, are impotent in themselves. And you will find in every case that they derive from the past, from the known. They are not pure creation. They never can be pure creation. So, if we take that, if we approach the understanding of man in those terms, we shall see that fundamentally man is a creator. Not in the sense of creating a poem or a symphony, a scheme or a plan or anything like that. But creation is something we don't know and we cannot know. In the uttermost deeps of our own consciousness, creative activity can take place and does take place only insofar as all this superficial activity of the psychophysical organism comes to a state of stillness and silence, but a state of complete awakenedness. Then creation takes place, which the brain never knows. But that creation which takes place there is and makes an impress of its creative energy upon the whole organism, and later on concepts and verbal formulations and physical action may emerge, which happens to be in line with this original creative activity in that state of stillness and silence, but complete awakenedness. You see? Now, this is the way the sort of great inspirations and the profound insights emerge. All right. Now, the prefix hu for human, H-U, as you know, in Sanskrit and Avastan, su, S-U, and H-U are interchangeable terms. You see, in the Zarathustrian scriptures, we have the threefold presentation of hu mata, the good thought, the happy thought, hu ukta, the good word, hu vrashta, the good deed. And if you take Buddhistic terminology, you will find that he who has become the enlightened one and realized, and nirvana is realized through him, he is the one who is called the su-gata. The Avastan would say the hu-gata. This says su-gata, the happily gone, gone thus happily. Not in our sense of the word happiness, but in the divine sense of the bliss of God, which passes all understanding. The happily gone one. So now, man. Let us start there and understand that man is created in the living likeness of this primordial creative energy, which we may name God or Brahman or any word you like, or if you like, use Hamilton's, the English philosopher Hamilton's term, the unconditioned, you see, or if you like, Aristotle's term, the prime mover, and so forth. You can use any word you like, doesn't matter. So long as we understand the significance of the word man. Now, If man, individual man, you, I, anybody, everybody, arrives, grows into, through discipline, and discipline means growing happily and healthily. That is its fundamental meaning. Growing happily and healthily. Not compelling yourself, not being compelled to live in conformity with this, that, or the other. But through growing happily and healthily, if you are in tune with this, then that supreme creative energy, that creative power, that divine creative power has come to fruition in that person as the perfect man. You may call him, as they said, as they called him in India and also in Kabbalistic teachings, the perfected Holy One. The perfected Holy One. Because this at last is true man, the flower of humanity. Right. Now, this flower of humanity is something so wonderful that we can't describe it. We ordinarily say, oh, he has become the enlightened one. He is the Prince of Peace, the Lord of Love, terms which are used for the Buddha, for Jesus, and so forth, and throughout the religions of the world and all religious teachings. But it is not he who has become enlightened. But enlightenment, transcendent love, transcendent wisdom, are constitutive of him. That's what he's made up of. Made up of. That is the stuff of that living being, if you like to put it in those terms. It is constitutive of him. In other words, something has come to fruition, has found release in expression. And that expression extends right from the profoundest depths of his own consciousness to all the simple little things that he does in everyday life. Those virtues, if you like, those qualities find expression there. So now, to talk in terms of following a discipline or practicing a method which, until we arrive at the light, is only a partial view of the whole thing. Because the whole thing continuously takes place in eternity. It continuously is of the nature of the infinite, not the finite. Because the finite is perishable, it's mortal. Enlightenment, love, wisdom, truth, beauty, goodness, the words we use in that transcendent context are not mortal. They are not finite. They are immeasurable. You see, it's very difficult to appreciate this. We may appreciate it with the top layer of our brain cells, but that's useless. Because when we go out into the street and see something which is offensive to us, we will hardly be expressing transcendent love under those circumstances. So you see, it's not with the top layer of the brain cells, but we have to sort of become completely soaked with the reality of this. Let us be soaked. Don't try to soak yourselves, because that is a selfish pursuit. Let it happen. It will happen by itself. Just as if your body is healthy, your digestive process happens by itself. You don't have to do anything about it. It happens like that. So now, if we realize that, then we realize the true meaning of the word discipline. It's a process of learning all the time. And this learning is not an acquiring. You do not acquire any knowledge in this situation. You acquire knowledge in the worldly sense, where you are concerned with the finite, the temporal, the mortal, the particular, and so forth. But if we understand that man is what he is in its profoundest meaning, then you are no longer dealing with the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. You are concerned with, or shall I say, the totality is concerned with infinity, immortality, eternity as expressed through you, who are the unresisting medium. So that this discipline, this process of learning, is a process of growing happily from within. Now, any accepted technique does not bring out this aspect. It may facilitate the possibility for this aspect to work. And it does, actually, up to a point, provided that the discipline that one follows, the laid-down discipline, does not become a mental fixation. When does anything become a mental fixation, and therefore a block to the psyche, to the mind, and prevent it growing? When does it become a mental fixation? When you cling to the conceptual and verbal formulation of the meaning that is embodied in what has been said or written. If you cling to that, you'll never grow. What we do is we tell the mind, this is the truth, now nothing else. Well, if you stop there, you have become static, you've become a fossil. That is to say that the mind fossilizes. The mind is continuously growing, and growth means perpetual change. So there is no such thing as arriving at enlightenment or arriving at the end of the road. Where is the road? There is no road. If you want to really to understand the path, your living being is the path. Your living process is the walking on that path. And that living process includes every single activity, every single thing that happens to you and through you. You see? That happens to you and through you. So now, obviously, one doesn't have to wait for the time when the light will be there. The light is constantly there. I am responsible for preventing that light from lighting up inside me. But that light keeps on growing. There comes the point when one awakes to the fact that, this is in line with universal truth, universal reality. And then one may think, yes, now I've got some light. But don't stay there. You will grow continuously. You look at the lives of the great founders of the religions. If you take the case of Jesus, for instance, the baptism by water. Why did he say, although John the Baptist said, I'm not worthy to baptize you and so forth. Oh no, let it be thus. There's a profound symbolical meaning to it. Because that is the initial stage, which is followed by other baptisms later on, culminating anything like the baptism by fire in the way Christianity has presented it. The cross, the crucifixion, the final baptism by fire, if you like. You have this idea of the baptism by fire symbolized in that Elijah-Elisha story, when Elijah is taken up in the fiery chariot by the horses and the horsemen of Israel, as Elisha says, are seen by him, and so forth. You have this same idea of the baptism by fire in the supreme stages that one goes through in one's process of opening out completely and becoming utterly free of anything and everything in the psyche which obstructs truth, the full truth. So now, that process goes on. It doesn't stop. When we say baptism by fire and sort of say we have come to an end, that is a mistake. In the life of Jesus, the teachings become more and more wonderful as the months pass by. Just hardly 3 years. 3 years according to the calendar, but actually he taught for only about 20 or 21 months before the crucifixion, from the time he started till the time he was crucified. In the case of the Buddha, it is stated at 35 enlightenment took place. But at the age of 51, an even profounder teaching came out of him, which underlies the teachings put forward in Mahayana Buddhism. And towards the end of his life, the profoundest teachings came out. And you will notice that when these things happen, it is generally represented symbolically in the life of the teacher as a transfiguration. If you take Moses, you get the same thing. He goes up to the Mount of the Lord and is there 40 days and nights. Obviously, this was no mountain that he climbed. Some people say the Mount of the Lord was Mount Sinai. But I think we can dismiss that. The Mount of the Lord simply means the supreme state of consciousness into which you yourself are lifted up. That is the Mount of the Lord. And you find in the case of Moses, and when he came down, that means came back to ordinary consciousness, his face shone. You find the same idea of transfiguration in the case of Zarathustra. This idea of the complete transfiguration. And in the case of the Buddha, you find the same thing happening the night of the enlightenment and shortly before his death, and I don't know of any other occasions. But this sort of thing, this is the sort of thing that happens. Which means that our discipline never ends. It is not like taking a course in physics or electronics or whatever it is and coming to the end of the course and there we are, we've finished, we've learned. No. Life means life. A constant living, a constant growing. What is not in tune with that growing process is discarded by life. And life has no compunction whether you get hurt in the process of that discarding or not hurt. That is our responsibility altogether. So now, if we understand this, our whole approach to whatsoever we undertake, whatsoever objective we set before us undergoes a change until the point comes when we have no laid down objective, because the objective is not outside us. The objective is within us. And it is this objective within us, as we may so term it, not very accurately, which is the objective of the total cosmos in maintaining and supporting us and coming to fruition through us as the perfect Holy One. You see, the whole thing is turned inside out that way, isn't it? It's a complete metanoia, if you like. A complete transformation, a transmutation. And when that happens, we are beginning to understand the meaning of man and of the human life, of religious living, and so forth. Now, take the question which naturally arises. Every one of us is perfectly sincere and earnest about living of the religious life. But how far do we understand the implications of living that life? And this is quite a different matter. It is this complete turning around in the innermost seat of consciousness. Now, if we do this, or rather, as we progress in the real sense of the word progress along this way, then what happens to us individually in relationship to others around us? We are the odd man out, each one of us. Each one of us is the odd man out. The rest of the world is not like that. Walk into a pub or go to your club, whether it be in Pall Mall or whether it be wherever it is. You see, go to your club. Go to your particular society, the such and such a society which is noted for such and such cultural pursuits and has a very high reputation and so forth. But you will be the odd man out if you are like this and the rest are not like that. Or within your own family, in your own home, you are the odd person out. The question arises then of human relationships. Now, if we think in terms like this, that, oh, my family is an obstruction to me, my particular firm in which I work, they are all an obstruction to me in my development spiritually. If we think in those terms, we have failed to understand the meaning of discipline. We being what we are, and we being in this particular circumstance, placed there not merely by our choosing does play a part. If you want to join Ford workers, right, you'll be in a Ford factory. That much is your choosing, but it is actually the whole environment which has conspired to put you into that particular position at that moment and for so many years or decades or whatever it is in that particular situation. Now, if we are intelligent, we will see at once this is our heaven-sent opportunity for learning. What have we got to learn? We are at loggerheads with the family, with our neighbors, with the boss, with the employer, with the other employees. We are at loggerheads with all of them. What have we got to learn? This is one's own individual problem. how to respond to the whole circumstance, how to respond to each and every particular person who comes our way in such a manner that we have ceased to helplessly react either for or against this, that, or the other person. The problem of aversions and attachments comes in straight away. Problem, difficulty. You see? Now, of course, this is no weak-kneed person's task. It requires a truly heroic soul not to battle through the situation, but to respond and not react to the situation. And this is where the release of true intelligence begins to take place in us. Now, why do I say that the release of true intelligence begins there? Because in order to respond to any person, and this applies responding to any particular event or situation or circumstance, whatever it is, you see, in order to respond in the right way, the rightest possible way for us individually, according to what we are at the moment, you see, one has to pay full attention to that person or situation or event or condition or whatever it is. Now, obviously, if we are caught up in an earthquake or a volcano overflows and engulfs us, that is the end of paying attention to it. But, there's no need to discuss the matter further, because either Mrs. or Mr., the wife or the husband, will get the, 2,000 or odd pounds for which you are insured. So you can't consider that anymore. That's the end of that. But we have to pay full attention whilst we are alive. Now, what is the implication of paying full attention? Is there anybody? There are, but you can count them on your fingers' ends in the world. You see? There is hardly anybody who is capable of full attention. Now, I have been speaking so many words. Have you been able to notice what your own brain was doing whilst I was talking? Was it or was it not talking back at me in agreement or disagreement, praise or censure, a feeling of, this is it, or, this is frightfully confusing, the man's an awful waffler, and so forth and so forth? Now, isn't our own brain doing that all the time? In other words, oneself, the conditioned self, is reacting all the time helplessly at the other person. Now, that way we can't consider a thing properly. Let us remind ourselves the meaning of the word consider. Con, together with sidus, sideris, a star. What is a star? A self-shining light. It is not visible by reflected light, its own light. To consider in the true sense means, therefore, to get entirely fully in touch with this self-shining light within oneself. And therefore, selflessly to listen to the spoken word to look at the written word, to and treat everything in nature, in everyday life, whatever it is, to treat everything in that way. Give it complete attention, therefore. And in that giving of complete attention, I, the subject who is attending, is not there to spoil the attentiveness. As long as one is even in the hidden depths of one's consciousness, aware of I, the self, am listening, I, the self, am looking, and so forth, full attention isn't there. It's a partial attention. It is an attention which is bedeviled by one's own conditioning, by one's own beliefs, convictions, conceptions, ideas, and so forth. The beliefs, the conceptions, the ideas need not at all be untrue. They may be perfectly true. But I, the person who holds those beliefs, conceptions, etc., have only a limited picture of it. And when I listen like that, or look with all that affecting me, I am casting my limitation upon that which is being looked at or listened to. Therefore, it's not a pure listening. It's not a pure looking. It is not seeing in the true sense. And you'll ask, what is seeing in the true sense? I've tried to suggest seeing with complete attention, in which self-consciousness no longer obtrudes upon the act of seeing. Some of you, perhaps all of you, may have had those wonderful divine moments in life when you suddenly realize that, yes, this is, I've seen it, actually seen it. Of course it is like this, you see. And you will notice, retrospectively, of course, that in that state, mind and consciousness were actually what you were seeing or hearing. That sort of seeing and hearing is a seeing and hearing by being what you see and hear. Now the same can apply to the world of ideas, not merely to the external phenomenon, or the other person, as we call him. It can happen in the world of ideas. And then, that idea has become a living, creative energy within you, no longer restricted to its conceptual and verbal clothing. No longer restricted. You have, as I said earlier, grown from within. And this is the emergence of wisdom in the true and profound sense of the word. You cannot acquire wisdom. You cannot obtain wisdom from anybody else. You cannot buy it, you cannot sell it. It is something within yourself. Consider your own life energy. What can you do with it? It does with you all the time. It deals unto you. You can't lay down anything to your own life energy. It is the mysterious, untouchable, indestructible reality. It's quite extraordinary that primitive peoples, miscalled primitive in this respect, thousands of years ago had a sense of this indestructibility of the life essence within them. But we have become so clever with our modern development and all the rest of it and knowledge that that innate wisdom has become overlaid with acquired knowledge. Acquired knowledge has its place. It enables you to have the technical know-how for finite expression. But it is wisdom which is the living insight. And wisdom never makes a mistake. That is the real meaning of the word buddhi. It is the real meaning of Plato's nous, that noetic quality of which the old Greeks spoke, and so forth. If we begin to live in that manner, then what happens to the disagreements with those around us? As far as oneself is concerned, one has ceased to be a source of conflict between oneself and the other person. But that doesn't mean necessarily that the other person will also cease to be in conflict with you, because one can't, as I said earlier, invade that inner sanctum which is his own soul. He may continue to do things and to live and deal with you in an obstructive manner, but you will be learning and growing happily all the time from within. You will not create an impenetrable armor around you, because that would mean shutting yourself off from that which is your teacher. If you learn from that, then you have conferred teacherhood upon that. The devil and all his hosts in hell, talking metaphorically, are amongst our finest teachers. Consider the lives of so many of the great mystics and saints. If not for the assiduous intervention of the devil in their lives, they would never have begun to see God. So you see, the devil is always active and God always looks on. And we complain, "Oh God, where art thou?" He doesn't say anything because he can't. He is inside here. Just watch and look, in the real sense of watching and looking. And then you will find that whatever discipline you follow, whatever problems you have with people, with situations, with circumstance, whatever difficulties you come across in your own life, they will all be resolved, not solved. The word solved has a sense of finality about it, like solving an algebraical or geometrical problem or something like that. That sort of solution is still in the realm of ambivalence, the ambivalence of the psyche, that's all. And that means that the psyche is still obstructing the light of transcendence. When transcendence works freely through you, you've gone right beyond all good and evil, which does not mean that now you can do what you like and have no ill consequence. The very reverse. The absolute virtue, the absolute good, is your foundation stone upon which you build the divine temple, which is the living psychophysical organism, the dweller in which is the unknown, eternal, immortal.